Issues surrounding race and racism are a big part of life in the United States, whether we want to talk about it or not. From poverty to education to mass incarceration rates, racial disparities are a big part of the story. And our next guest says one of the biggest challenges in confronting racial inequality is getting white people to talk about it. Robin DiAngelo is a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice. Her latest book is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, your book comes out of years of teaching in higher education and then in workshops and seminars for businesses and others. What do you mean by this idea of white fragility that came out of this?
Well, the term is meant to capture kind of two key parts. Fragility in that how little it takes to upset us as white people. So for many white people, the mere suggestion that being white has meaning will cause umbrage and defensiveness, much less generalizing about white people as a group. But the impact of that defensiveness is not fragile at all. It's a kind of weaponized hurt feelings, a weaponized defensiveness, because it pushes people of color and other white people who want to break with white solidarity, it pushes us away from challenging one another.
And you have a target audience in mind, and it isn't what people might think of when they think of white racism. It isn't a Ku Klux Klan member, say. You say one of the biggest problems you see is people who are racially progressive among white people.
Yeah, I often kind of facetiously say white progressives are my specialty, and that's because I am a white progressive. And when I first applied for a job to lead primarily other white people in discussions of racism, I thought it was a really simple matter of open-mindedness. And I am so clear, you know, close to two decades later, that open-mindedness identity as open-mindedness tends to function to keep us closed off, in fact, right? To the degree that we think we're, you know, free of racism and good to go, we're going to put our energy into making sure you see us as free of racism and good to go. And none of it really in where it needs to go for the rest of our lives, which is deep and ongoing critical self-knowledge, mistake-making, risk-taking, relationship building, and actual strategic anti-racist action. And I like to say that niceness is not anti-racist, but many white progressives think this is just a matter of being nice and friendly.
Right. You seem to come back to a theme of two different meanings of racism. One, that, okay, there are some bad people who have racist views and practice them and directly oppress people. And then what you were alluding to there, an idea that, no, this is it's a structure, it's a process, it's a history that that all of us are kind of caught up in.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally the structure that we're all in and that we've all been socialized in and that we can't help but participate in. But it's a highly adaptive structure. Right. I mean, we continue to have racially disparate outcomes by every measure. In many ways and measures, they're increasing, not decreasing. And yet most white people individually and definitely most white progressives see ourselves as free of racism. So we have to ask what's going on. And I think one of the most effective adaptations of the system of racism to the challenges of the civil rights movement was to reduce it to a really simple formula. A racist is an individual, not a system, who consciously does not like people based on race, must be conscious, and intentionally seeks to harm them. And that definition exempts virtually all white people from the system we're in and from looking any further at ourselves.
So for that white person who reacts to a conversation about racism with that definition and thinks, okay, well, that's not me. There are other people more racist than I am, so no worries there. What do you say to them about how to think about it differently?
Yeah, you know, I've been doing a lot of work lately with tech companies, and overwhelmingly the employees are very, very young, around in their 30s. They've been raised in this kind of colorblind idea, and they have no skills whatsoever to think critically about racism. And the very few people of color that work with them, and black people in particular, are in a lot of pain. Because if I can't think critically about how my race has shaped my life, I am not going to be able to hold how your race has shaped your life. In other words, if I can't tell you what it means to be white, I'm not going to be able to validate what it means not to be white. And that's going to be very unsettling to kind of challenge that very unracialized sense of self that I have. And so the people of color that are around us can't really talk to us about their experiences, much less any kind of unaware slights that we perpetrate. You know, most of the kind of racism that leads to incredible levels of stress for people of color day in and day out is not the really explicit stuff. I mean, I would never use the N-word, and I would never march in Charlottesville, but I'm really clear that my obliviousness and my racist framework. I mean, you can't grow up in this culture and not absorb racist messages, but they come out in very subtle ways. I mean, subtle to me, but they're not subtle to people of color. And that's that daily climate that they're having to navigate, and that comes from well-intended people like me. And it's one thing to be well-intended and not be aware, but when someone does point out something you weren't aware of, you need to be receptive. It's a kind of, oh my goodness, I would never want to say or do anything racist, but don't you dare tell me I just said or did something racist.
Talking to Robin DiAngelo about her new book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. And I guess a defensiveness is what I'm hearing you talk about there. The idea that, okay, if someone's a white progressive and says, okay, racism is bad, and if they're called on racism, that puts them in the category of bad person, and that's hard to deal with.
Yeah, you know, in addition to kind of a sense of exemption, right? I mean, individualism is a very precious ideology in our culture. It's really only granted to those of us who are white, you know, when we're thinking in racial terms. And so we just see ourselves as unique individuals, and we expect that that's how everybody else sees us. But, you know, people of color see us, you know, yes, you're an individual, and you're also white, and it has meaning. You know, you can literally predict whether someone will survive their birth and how long they'll live based on their race. And we have to be willing to grapple with the collective shared messages that we get as a result of being in this particular group, and set individualism aside a little bit, or else use it to figure out how what you see about yourself as unique and special and your particular story, how did all of that set you up into the overall structure, rather than how we tend to use our stories to exempt ourselves from the overall structure.
So a very common response, and you've touched on this, is people saying they're colorblind, they don't see color, not a racist bone in their body, that kind of thing. How do you talk to people who respond in that way?
Well, sometimes I share a story about standing beside a black man leading a workshop, and a white woman said to him, "I don't even see you as black." And he said, "Well, first, is there anything wrong with your eyes? Because I am black, and I do know you know that, and that you can see that. And if you refuse to acknowledge that, how are you going to see racism? How are you going to recognize that I'm having a different experience than you are? And definitely, how are you going to be able to support me around the parts of that experience that are really hurtful and problematic?" It's really a form of saying to someone, "I refuse to acknowledge your reality."
Is there a strategy that you found that overcomes that initial defensiveness, or is this just a doomed conversation from the start?
Well, I mean, one of the things I have going for me when I'm doing a workshop or a talk is that I have some time to lay some building blocks, right? I mean, if we're operating from two very different understandings of what it means to be racist, or, you know, participate in racism, then right there we're going to be kind of not being able to talk to each other. But I do try to point the finger inward rather than outward. And so I might, you know, I also, of course, want to reduce defensiveness. So I might relate to the person. Yeah, I've heard that joke before, or, you know, I've also had that thought and felt that feeling. And as a result of my work, I've had the opportunity to talk to people of color about what that joke is like for them, or, you know, what the impact of those feelings are on them. And I've had the opportunity to kind of put the human face to that. And I just can't tell that joke or share that feeling without seeing the face of, you know, my dear friend Deborah, for example. You know, notice that the first thing I did was acknowledge that I can relate to the thought. I've probably had it, the thought or the feeling. But I have some new information now, right? I have personalized the impact of that thought or feeling. And it doesn't necessarily shift the person, but it tends to have them think twice about whether they want to say that again. You know, notice I haven't said, "You're a racist." You know, I mean, there's a time when that might be a line that must be drawn, but mostly it's not particularly strategic.
We're talking to Robin DiAngelo right now. Her new book is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction? What are your thoughts to what you're hearing? Do you think it is difficult to have conversations about racism? Have you been in a setting where you'd think you had a productive conversation about issues of race? Where was that? How did that happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about racism and why it's so often difficult to have frank conversations about it. Our guest is Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you talk about race in your home, among your friends, or do you avoid the topic as much as possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for this topic. It's interesting to continue this conversation in our country. I'm kind of offended by the title, you know, about white fragility, because I'm not fragile in terms of my convictions or whatever, but I have a couple questions for the author, because my first question is, does she think Jesus was white? And of course he wasn't, but the fact that he is not white, and there are white people who take ownership for his vision and choose to see the world in a certain way, does not mean that they are responsible for racism or racists. And so her title itself suggests that white people are responsible for racism, and we are not. And that's my only comment in response to her.
All right. Jeff, thanks for the call. Robin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I have a PhD in race relations and white racial identity development. So, yes, I'm very well aware that Jesus was not white. But I think rendering him white is one of the very powerful ways that we communicate white superiority. I don't believe any white person can grow up in this society and not internalize a sense of superiority. And research shows that by age 3 to 4, all children who grow up here understand that it's better to be white. And it is better to be white in the sense of the privileges that are granted, the benefit of the doubt, the relentless reflection and centrality, the holding up white people as the norm for humanity, and the example of rendering images of God and his son and mother as white. And again, I just wonder, then, who is responsible for racism, right? I would highly recommend Ibram Kendi, National Award winning book, Stamped from the Beginning: The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It is a relatively new idea. It was generated to justify enslavement and genocide by people who we now categorize as white. So I would very clearly like to state that racism is a system created and wielded by white people.
Thanks for the call. I broke up there a bit. I'll go next to Cole with us in Milwaukee. Cole, hello.
Hi. Thank you. First off, thank you for having me on the show. So I just want to add a question for Robin. So I was raised in a predominantly white neighborhood, and I didn't have any interaction with anyone of color, basically. And I guess my question is, how do we engage white people that don't have the opportunity to talk to people of color in racist conversations or conversations about race?
That's a great question. Thank you so much. First, we have to understand the power of segregation and the power of calling segregated spaces good if they are white. Just notice that if a neighborhood is or a school is termed a good neighborhood, the assumption is going to be that it's going to be white. And so in many ways, white people measure the value of our environments by the absence of people of color. Those are incredibly deep messages. And I often think about, you know, that I could live my entire life basically only around white people. And no one has ever suggested to me that anything of value has been lost. I think that we really have to understand that that's active, right? That white space is not a fluke. It's not natural. It's not a result of just, you know, some people like to be with their own. It's the result of decades of policies and practices. And every moment we spend in white space, in segregation, we are being deeply reinforced, not only in the absence of that loss, but in a very limited worldview that's presented as objective and universal. And so what I often offer for white folks who grew up in primarily white environments, in some ways, you're actually even less sheltered from the forces of racism. We often think, oh, you know, I don't know anything. You know, I didn't grow up around people of color. But then who were you left to rely on? I mean, what were you left to rely on for your understanding, right? Certainly not a wide variety of authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships, but really, really problematic representations. And so I would walk them through a series of reflection questions. You know, how did you make sense of that separation if everyone was equal? What made a school good? What made a neighborhood good? What made a school bad? Who went to bad schools? Right? There's a lot of deep reflection that people can do to uncover the really early internalization of white superiority. And we can and do hold diametrically opposed beliefs, right? And the research in implicit bias is also clear about that. At the conscious level, I believe everyone is equal. But at the unconscious level, there's no way I could believe that. Because my entire life, I've been given messages that, you know, some groups of people are more valuable than others. I'm not really sure that that can be denied. I think we all know that some groups of people are positioned in society is inherently more valuable than other groups. So we have to get past this idea that to have internalized those messages makes us bad people. It doesn't. But we do have to take responsibility because the deeper biases shape our responses and our relationships. They come out in ways that we may not see, but that have powerful impacts on those around us.
Talking to Robin DiAngelo, author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. Robin, one thing that comes up sometimes here on the show, and I think in your experience, is the idea that talking about racism is in itself divisive and highlights racial differences in ways that would be better ignored. Is that something you come across?
Oh, yes. I did want to add one last thought to the last caller because I wanted to be really clear. People of color, even if they're not in our lives, we need to change that and build relationships. But there are many, many, many people of color who have written and speak and present and have videos. So the information from people of color is out there. We have to care enough to seek it out. Now, this idea that it's talking about race that divides us is kind of a funny one to me. I mean, we really are already divided by race. I would say not talking about that or grappling with that keeps us divided. And I would just offer a question back, which is, who does that narrative serve? I mean, who is more likely to say, let's not talk about an unequal society from which I benefit? And who's more likely to say we need to talk about an unequal society from which you benefit? In other words, that is generally not the narrative of people of color. And that should be a clue that it is problematic.
In our last minute or so, you've been doing this kind of thing for quite a while now. Do you see things changing much over time?
Oh, boy. I think what I feel really clear about is, unlike the way I was taught in school to think history is this arc of progress, I think it's pretty clear that systems are constantly kind of having to maintain power, and they're being, and they get challenged and they shift and then they respond. I think we're in a cycle right now of extreme and explicit racism. I think we're kind of back to a climate in which there is permission, much more social permission from the highest places of government to be really explicitly racist. We're way beyond dog whistle. And that's also galvanized people. And so it's a constant push and pull. I find my work actually easier. I mean, you know, I certainly get some pretty frightening emails, but I think there's a kind of shock and desperation for a lot of really well-intended white people who just don't understand what's going on. And so there's a receptivity there that I actually wasn't seeing before the current administration.
Robin, thanks for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Robin DiAngelo is a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice. We've been talking about her new book. It's called White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. She draws from her experience as a trainer on issues of race. The responses she's gotten from what she says are mainly racially progressive white people on issues of racism.